From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young, broadcasting today from WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland, Ohio, as we visit stations across the country.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We're getting reaction today to the president's order to send an additional 1,000 troops to the Middle East. The announcement came yesterday after Iran said it could breach the 2015 nuclear deal at the end of the month. That's if it doesn't get relief from sanctions imposed after President Trump pulled out of that deal last year. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is blaming Iran for attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman last week, something Iran denies. Joining us now is Congressman Adam Schiff, a Democrat of California and chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And first of all, what is your reaction to the idea of the U.S. sending more troops, 1,000 troops, to the Middle East?
Well, I'm desperately concerned that we avoid any action that could escalate matters or precipitate war with Iran. I think the evidence that Iran attacked these ships is very strong, and we ought to be working on a concerted response with our allies. But if we're going it alone, that gives me great pause, and it means, I think, that we have alienated a lot of our friends in Europe and elsewhere by reneging on the Iran nuclear agreement, and by taking actions that our allies feel have promoted this instability and helped bring about this crisis. So I'm very concerned that we not take actions that could escalate matters further.
What actions are you talking about that you think that the United States has taken to promote instability?
Well, I think probably the most serious action was reneging on the Iranian nuclear deal when Iran was in fact complying. And then we took steps more recently to prevent other countries from importing uranium from Iran, which I think has accelerated the timetable for Iran to reach the point where it's in violation of the nuclear agreement. Iran itself is taking provocative steps like increasing the pace of enrichment. But when we leave the agreement, we can't be all that surprised to find ourselves in these circumstances. It certainly doesn't justify Iran attacking ships or restarting its nuclear program, but it does mean that this was eminently predictable, and I think that's what our allies are reacting to.
Well, let's go back to what you said about the fact that you believe that there's strong evidence that Iran attacked these ships last Thursday. One of the ships was Japanese-operated, and the Japanese say they're not convinced that Iran was behind the attacks.
You know, I think that part of the reluctance I think we see in our allies has less to do with whether they're persuaded that Iran is responsible for the attack on these ships. There aren't a whole lot of other candidates for this action. I think the intelligence is very strong, but rather a reluctance to take steps with the United States that they think could lead us to warfare. So from my point of view, this is less about intelligence. It's more a reaction to the United States going it alone, reneging on international agreements that were working, and putting us in a position where we're not unified in responding to Iran's malevolent behavior.
Do you think the Trump administration is preparing for war with Iran?
Well, I think there's a division of opinion within the administration, apparently between the president and Bolton and Pompeo. Apparently, the president sought to have the Japanese prime minister, while visiting Iran, make an overture on the U.S. behalf to return to the negotiating table. But at the same time, you have Bolton announcing on the eve of that we were imposing new sanctions on Iran. Now, whether that was deliberately intended to scuttle this initiative by the president or it was just a lack of coordination, I don't know. But the result is, I think, a very incoherent policy.
We spoke yesterday with the BBC's Mark Lowen in the region, who said, quote, "Nobody wants conflict in this region, but the fear is that an unintentional conflict could break out. And that, of course, would be devastating. And, of course, the ghosts of the Iraq War still stalk this region, and no side wants to really come to blows." What about that? How worried are you that the U.S. could again end up in a conflict with a country in the Middle East based on false intelligence?
Well, I am very concerned about the United States and Iran bungling their way into war. You know, again, I think the intelligence here in terms of the attack on these ships is pretty clear. I also thought the intelligence on Iraq, I have to say, and I wasn't was strong, although I wasn't on the intelligence committee at the time and didn't have the same both access and understanding of the intelligence that I do now. But I really think this is less an issue of intelligence and more an issue of what we do with that intelligence.
What do you think should happen now? Is there any chance of preventing Iran from breaching its agreement and enriching more uranium than it should under the terms of the deal that the U.S., of course, pulled out of?
You know, I think there is a chance of getting Iran to remain in the agreement, but to the degree that, you know, we continue to take steps to force Iran's hand by, you know, as I was mentioning, the State Department announcing in May that it would use sanctions against countries that facilitated the export of uranium from Iran. Well, if Iran can't export its uranium, then it's more likely to have a stockpile that's in excess of the allowable limits. Now, Iran could just stop enriching. But again, this is a situation when you have both countries, Iran and the United States, taking action that seems to be leading us into the dead end of conflict. And that only increases the chance that this have a really bad outcome.
That's Congressman Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, now to how the trade war with China has crushed the packaging products industry over the last several months here in the U.S. There seems to be no relief in sight for American business owners. And to Western cities like Phoenix, which have been wholly dependent on the U.S.-China relationship to fully process recycled paper, it's about more than just trade. As Heather Van Blockland from member station KJZZ reports, it's about how U.S. and Chinese business owners must work together to keep one industry alive.
Brian Boland is a paper guy. He started in paper in 1995, and he's seen things change dramatically.
People hear that you've got foreign investment coming into the U.S., but one thing to remember is that to see growth and to see investment in these facilities that have been here literally since the late 1800s. It's really, really cool. It's really powerful stuff.
Boland started in paper in Michigan, just out of school. He's moved a few times and changed companies a few times, mostly through buy-ups and buyouts. Boland's worked for Mead Paper and Catalyst Paper and now ND Paper, the Chinese company that's bought 4 U.S. paper mills over the last year, with plans to buy more. ND Paper is the U.S. operation of Nine Dragons Paper Holdings, the largest paper company in China, and one of the largest in the world. Boland is based at ND's Ohio office. With no end in sight to the trade war with China, these buy-ups and buyouts are making industry insiders nervous. But business operators like Pete Keller, Vice President of Recycling and Sustainability at Republic Services, the second largest waste company in the U.S., say the industry needs to be saved by its operators.
When I say the business model is broken in the U.S., it's broken. 18 months ago, cardboard was trading for around $150 a ton. Mixed paper and other paper products were trading for around $100 a ton. And cardboard today is trading for about $50 a ton. And those other paper grades are trading for around zero.
75% of Republic Services business is dependent on paper. Keller says a lot has changed in the last year.
You know, I would say this relative to recycling. If the material that's being recovered and aggregated and ultimately marketed isn't going back into a manufacturing process, it isn't getting reintroduced as some other product, then it's not recycling.
Prices in the U.S. for recycled cardboard are at a decade low since China stopped buying the U.S. product. In January of 2018, China established its National Sword Policy, an effort to clean up its own environment and reduce pollution. That includes drastically changing its import policy on recycled paper, in addition to tariffs on paper products. The global recycling business went into a tailspin, hitting recycled paper particularly hard. Joe Judis is Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Phoenix.
Those products are not selling nearly at the prices that they used to. In some cases, people are paying to move their paper. It's affecting a lot of municipalities, a lot of operations in terms of the revenues that they're accustomed to receiving from selling recycling are not there anymore. And so those shortfalls, for example, in Phoenix, those shortfalls in budget are things we have to make up.
China consumes approximately 1/4 of all global paper products. About 1/4 of its consumption has to be imported, since China does not have the natural resources to keep up with its population demand. In 2017, China imported 26 million metric tons of scrap paper. In 2018, that dropped to 15 million. 2019 is on pace to drop even more. Judy says the solution to their trade problem is not trade negotiations, but with U.S. mills, which need to produce cleaner products across the U.S. The U.S.-based mills bought by Chinese-owned ND Paper already do, since they produce paper pulp, a finished product that's contaminant-free and can be exported to China as is, even with an added tariff.
So essentially, they're making their new cardboard boxes or products here in the United States and then shipping them back to China to put the toys and other products that they're manufacturing that are going to then get back in the box and come back over to the United States or wherever else people are buying them from. So it's a very unique international trade situation going on there.
For Here and Now, I'm Heather Van Blockland in Phoenix.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over air conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, control your comfort.
Fifty years ago this week, the profoundly polluted Cuyahoga River burst into flames. Now, there's lots of myths about that fire, but its legacy is clear. It fueled the country's young environmental movement, later the creation of the EPA and the Clean Water Act. For many, the river is frozen in flames from a photograph from that time, but the fire is long gone. And as we found out at the river's banks, that fire also changed the lives of Clevelanders, like kayaker Kate Schneider.
I grew up in Cleveland. I know Cleveland really well. But when I'm on the river, I have no idea where I am because I've grown up in a city where we've turned our backs to our lakes and rivers. And so we don't really know what it's like. Like, I'm walking around, I'm like, oh, that's a coffee shop I used to go to all the time. But I'm paddling past it and I have no frame of reference of my geography.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake.
Yes, they're kayaking on the Cuyahoga. It's more than the songs written about it, like Randy Newman's Burn On. And to some natives like Jane Goodman, executive director of the Cuyahoga River Restoration, that song's part of the problem. Can we just start with the myths about this? We've been listening to Randy Newman's, you know, you're making a face, you know, burn, river burn.
I wish he would write a new song, or at least a new verse.
About how it's not burning anymore.
People who live here think it's still burning. Believe me, there are people who say to me, oh, you mean the river that catches on fire.
Burn on, big river, burn on.
So, let's set the record straight. So the actual fire in 1969 was a few miles upriver from where we are, sparked from a train going over a trestle, lit some of the garbage on the river on fire. But it only lasted 20 minutes?
Give or take.
In fact, there are no pictures of it.
That's right. Not only because it was over so fast, but because it was such a common occurrence. When it was mentioned the next day in the paper, it was like in an inner page. It wasn't even front page news.
And then Time magazine picks up the idea of the river catching on fire, does a piece, and they use a picture from 1952.
Yes. Which was much more photogenic.
This picture is the thing that sparks, literally, you know, excuse the pun, the budding environmental movement, eventually the EPA. Explain the context, 1969. What was going on that this became such a big story?
It was a perfect storm. Lewis Stokes, being a congressman, Carl Stokes, his brother, having been elected as the first African-American mayor of a major American city, Carl Stokes recognized that this wasn't just a water quality issue, it was a social justice issue. He got the city to pass a $100 million bond to start cleaning up the river. At the same time, the Time magazine article came out. There was this terrific photo of the 1952 fire, and people bought it because it was a follow-up to the moon landing, and on the cover was Teddy Kennedy in a neck brace. It was the Chappaquiddick issue. So the reason so many people found out about it was because they read that issue of Time magazine.
Well, thank goodness, because change began there. But, Jane, can you describe, we've seen pictures, we'll have some at herenow.org. I can't believe the pictures of the cars that were lining the banks, like abandoned cars, nose first, to what, keep the riverbank back?
Yeah, when you don't respect a waterway as a river, you just see it as an open sewer dump site. You don't know how to stabilize banks. You put whatever you can there.
This was considered the price of industrialization. You had sewage, you had oil and gas and
tar, building materials, chemicals. Everything you didn't want in your neighborhood, you put by the river.
And how often had it caught on fire?
1969 was the 13th fire that we know of.
It looked to us in a picture we saw, they were literally sucking things out, like giant vacuums sucking things out of the river. How did it get cleaned up?
So Frank Samsel, who started the chandlery that served the maritime businesses, just decided to outfit a boat called the Putzfrau, cleaning lady in German. That made it possible for the rest of the major cleanup efforts to happen.
Well, we made our way over to Samsel Supply, the massive marine supply and servicing company right on the river, where we met Frank Samsel's now grown children, Kathy Petrick and Mike Samsel. Nice to meet you. Hey.
Hi.
Hi, Robin.
Hi, Robin.
And
hi.
Mike Samsel, your dad, Frank, we understand, outfitted this boat with what to clean up the river?
Dad designed the boat to use a vector, which would pick up the oil off the surface of the water. And in the after end of the boat, there was a crane that would pick up all the debris. And we'd put those in 18-yard dumpsters. Those would be removed with the truck. And then we'd pump the oil out of the boat.
You went out with them?
Oh, yeah.
How bad was it?
Pretty nasty. But it's gotten better. I mean, look at it now.
But did your dad, I mean, did he get paid to do this?
Well, my dad's an entrepreneur, so he saw that they were picking up oil pretty inefficiently, straw, different items like that. He thought, I can do a better job. And I can make some money at it. So he had to do two things. He had to invent the equipment and then do it competitively so that he got the jobs.
So, Kathy, we understand this coming weekend there's going to be a torch that will come down the river, sort of symbolic of the fire that was here before. I think your dad's going to be honored. I mean, what's your sense of that?
Well, I think it's wonderful that we've come so far and that they are giving Dad credit for some of the work that he's done and everything. We're so proud for Cleveland. I mean, they cleaned up the river so fast that within 20 years, the boat was out of service. It's taken the last 30 years to really just clean the rest of it.
What's it like to look out on the river now?
Oh, it's amazing. To see the boats come up and to see recreation and industry are working together, because there was no recreation down here whatsoever.
The river itself, or this section here, is becoming more of a neighborhood, you know. And people are working together and playing together, you know.
You must be proud.
Oh, very proud. I'm proud of Dad and really, just like Kathy, I'm proud of the city, you know. Proud of the people of the city of Cleveland, too, to come together and fix this up.
Back on the river, Jane Goodman, again of the Cuyahoga River Restoration, agrees. It was the people of Cleveland, businesses, environmentalists, citizens, who decided their river needed protection.
So when you stop poisoning something, it can start healing. Most of the recovery had to do with businesses being regulated, not being able to add to the problem. And this wasn't just Clean Water Act, it was Clean Air Act, because a lot of what landed on the river came from smokestack industries.
We understand that Cuyahoga means curving river.
Well done.
And you still will have these huge vessels coming down here, and it gets kind of crowded at times. How are you managing the new recreational use with the ongoing industrial use?
Very carefully. When people started using it recreationally, the operators of those huge vessels were terrified, and they still are. They don't want to kill anybody, but they cannot see a stand-up paddleboarder.
We'll post a video at herenow.org of some of these huge vessels still making their way down this curvy river. It's frightening.
Yes. And remember, those ships are 700 feet long and they're 100 feet wide. This river at its widest is 136 feet.
We understand there are students that go around and hand out flyers. They go around in little boats and hand out flyers warning people. They could be big ships coming through here.
Oh, yeah.
But just what has happened for the city because it got cleaned up and people are using it?
Some of the people who never would have invested now see it as a prime place to invest. People who would not have lived on the river now see it as a wonderful place to live. People who would never have thought to bring their kayak past the natural river now bring it into the ship channel. The warehouses that the river brought cargo to are now lofts and apartments and condos, and they're sold out. Amazing things can happen when you don't give up.
The Cuyahoga River still has a ways to go. Some sections, for instance, remain on the list of impaired waters monitored by the Clean Water Act. And remember kayak instructor Kate Schneider? Well, she says she still sees garbage out on the river, and her parents don't want her to fall in. But
I mean, it's just kind of beautiful, the types of birds I've seen. I've seen tons of blue herons. There are, like, these sort of surprises that I see all the time. I think it's special, and I think it's a really interesting route because, like, I paddle all over North America, and this is one of the few places where I can be paddling and then see a large container ship, cargo ship, right beside me, and then a bunch of people rowing. So I think that's kind of interesting and beautiful about
it. It's urban.
It's very urban.
All right, let's get going, get you on the water.
Bye, you guys have fun.
Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me. Cleveland, even now I can remember. Cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking to my dreams.
Much to do this weekend on this, the 50th anniversary of the Cuyahoga River Fire. Rowing events, blazing paddles, the Paddle Fest. Tomorrow, the Native American Water Blessing.
Burn on, big river, burn on.
There are still questions about those attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman last week and how a conflict with Iran might threaten oil supplies. A review: Iran is under sanctions, so allies of the U.S. aren't buying its oil for fear of penalties. The same is true of Venezuela. So with so much supply either threatened or offline, oil prices should be high. Instead, at about $60 a barrel, oil is down nearly 20% from where it was just last April, 2 months ago. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hello there, Robin.
So after these oil tanker attacks in the Gulf of Oman last week, oil prices jumped. We know that about a third of all seaborne crude flows through that part of the world.
Yep.
There was some concern, you know, about what could get through. Now prices have fallen again. Why?
Well, there are a few things going on. One is that, you know, the president has said something different than his advisors have about those attacks. At one point, the U.S. has released evidence that they believe Iran hit these Japanese tankers. Mm-hmm. Then the president has come out and called the attacks very minor. America is now sending more troops to the Middle East. So on one hand, that feels like an escalation. But if you're an oil producing country, you're thinking, oh, wow, great, there are going to be more troops here so our ships can get through. Keep in mind that Arabian Gulf, the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman, it's a very narrow strait. And mm-hmm. all that oil that goes from much of the oil goes to the Middle East, goes out that way. So this always happens. When there are increased threats with Iran, the price goes up. And then when the threats decrease a little bit, like they have in the last 24 hours or so, you see the price coming back down.
Well, we also see this glut. How much of it is because of the falling demand? And how much is it because of increased supply because of new sources like shale
fracking?
Yeah.
This is interesting. Oil prices, there are two kinds of prices for oil. There's the U.S. price and there's the global price. Let's talk about the global price because that's what we're talking about, being about $60 a barrel. It has been as low as about 59 and as high as about 72 in the last month. Now, when you think about what it costs to frack in the United States, oil has to be at the 60 or higher point. If it's lower than that, American producers pull back on their production. You know, drilling oil in the ground, a hole in the ground and getting oil in Texas is much cheaper, but most of our oil is now fracking. So the Saudis and OPEC want oil to be high enough that they can make a lot of money, but not so high that the U.S. starts producing too much oil. So this price of oil, 62, 63 bucks to 65, almost to $70, that tends to be a pretty good amount, and there is a bit of an oversupply. So the OPEC countries are now thinking about pulling that back a little bit.
Well, just to let us know then, because Saudi Arabia announced this week it's going to cut its oil supply to try to boost prices.
Yes.
And it's calling on other OPEC countries to do the same thing. So where does that get into, you know, a trouble area if we want to keep the prices at around where they are?
So it's always hard to tell, but $70, even $80 doesn't tend to be a trouble area for oil. Once you get past 100, which, by the way, these countries that make most of their money from oil would really enjoy, people start to change their driving habits. People start to buy cars that are, lower fuel. So at the moment, we're not in a trouble area. The Saudis and OPEC would like oil to be a little higher than it is. So would the Americans. Probably the next 10 bucks or so a barrel, it's not going to undermine anything.
Right. They don't want people not buying it.
Correct.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
There's been a huge surge of high schoolers using e-cigarettes or vaping.
Popularity of e-cigarettes and vaping continues to rise.
3 million high school students this year using e-cigarettes, up more than 75%.
And this week, 40 state attorneys general called on the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to regulate e-cigs just like it regulates tobacco.
We're here today.
The use of vape pens, electronic cigarettes, and other electronic nicotine delivery systems has exploded over the last decade or so, especially among teenagers. According to the Food and Drug Administration, more than 3.6 million middle and high school students used e-cigarettes last year. That's an increase of nearly 80% among high schoolers and nearly 50% among middle schoolers over the year before. The thing is, compared with traditional cigarettes, there's very little research on the effects, and the industry is booming. It'll be worth more than $40 billion by 2025. The FDA is the part of the government that would regulate e-cigarettes, and that agency has funded research at the University of Louisville in Kentucky.
So you'll hear this pinch valve make a click, and that'll start the puff.
We stopped by the lab and donned Tyvek jumpsuits to limit contamination. We were in the lab of Dr. Daniel Conklin. He and his team of researchers are studying the effects of vaping using a device that inhales from e-cigarettes and analyzes the vapor to study the effects on lab mice.
What we have set up here are a number of different parts of our contraption here to smoke cigarettes or vape e-cigarettes and then pump that aerosol or smoke, as we call it, into a chamber that we will house our animals.
And there's actually a little vape pen inside there.
Correct.
So it's acting like a person would be in vaping.
Exactly. So we can control the volume of the puff, so it's consistent with kind of the puff volume that people would take, and the duration. So the combination of those things kind of replicate what's in the real world. But I have to tell you, the real world's very diverse when it comes to electronic cigarettes. Some people just do very light drags on their e-cigs. Others take bigger puffs in order to make vape clouds and do cloud tricks and so on.
And what are you trying to figure out?
We're trying to figure out whether or not electronic cigarettes increase the risk of cardiovascular disease or heart disease. That's pure and simple. We use models that are short-term, such as looking for biomarkers of a youth who uses an e-cigarette just a few times. And we also do chronic exposures, long-term, to look for changes in the vascular wall of the blood vessels that look like changes that would occur in a chronic smoker.
What they've found is that e-cigarettes are far from harmless, especially for the cardiovascular system. Conklin is looking for a link to diseases like atherosclerosis, when plaque clogs your arteries.
The more Long-term studies where we've looked at atherosclerosis as an outcome, we've done several of those studies, and as this is a really important endpoint, kind of a gold standard amongst cardiovascular researchers. So we've actually done those studies twice to validate that the findings we have are consistent, and we see increased atherosclerosis. We have not published these data yet because we're also interested in a second question, and this is really important. What in e-cigarette aerosols then are responsible for increasing this heart disease risk? Because the FDA is interested in regulating e-cigarettes, but they want to regulate particular constituents that are harmful. And so we're trying to figure out what components of the aerosol of e-cigs is contributing to the injury to the heart. Our idea is actually that nicotine itself is actually not benign under these conditions. And we have a number of other parallel studies where we've exposed animals to nicotine alone and seen increases in these markers of heart disease. So that's a kind of a troubling thing for anybody who says e-cigarettes are a safe product. If they contain nicotine, they're not only addictive, they're problematic for heart disease.
Is it difficult to research something that's so new? I mean, 5 years ago, nobody was smoking these things, or at least you didn't see them out on the street. The way that you do now, people are vaping all the time.
This is very challenging to study individual products. You know, 5 years ago, Blu was the king of the e-cigs.
Now it's Juul.
You're exactly right. And the products have changed in size and shape, voltage. Some of the constituent flavors have kind of varied. Some of them you can't even figure out what flavorings are present in there. Gummy bear, for instance. Tell me what flavors are in there. And Juul has raised the roof on the level of nicotine. Personally, I think anybody who sees the uptake of e-cigarettes amongst youth should be concerned about long-term consequences for these people, because we just don't know what the health risks are.
Because there's so much focus with smoking on lung cancer. What you're saying is it causes a lot of other problems as well.
There's no question that epidemiology says, you know, 500,000 people die premature deaths due to smoking. And that's just cardiovascular disease. So, and that's more than any other single cause of disease.
And that could be just as bad in an e-cigarette as in a traditional cigarette, or at least it could be bad enough that it's a problem.
I think there's some warning signs for heart disease with electronic cigarettes. And these are not just from our animal studies. I'm representing a number of studies done around the world that show that acute exposure to e-cigarettes, including in non-smoking adults, produces a temporary injury to the blood vessel that's equivalent to that same non-smoker using a conventional tobacco cigarette. So that's worrisome.
There are also some people that point to e-cigarettes and say this is a way for people who smoke traditional cigarettes to stop smoking. They can turn to this instead. When you hear that as somebody who's researching the effects of the e-cigarettes, what do you say?
Well, I don't actually study cessation, so this is a little bit difficult to say my research applies to this question. It's a really important one, because for those people who are trying to quit smoking, that would be the best thing for them, but it's very challenging. It takes at least 6 attempts on average for a chronic smoker to be able to quit. If e-cigarettes outside of traditional pathways can add to that improvement in that number, I say great. In the U.S., from my knowledge of this area, is that cessation has not been improved by inclusion of e-cigarettes. And there could be risk switching completely from cigarettes to e-cigarettes, because we don't know the risks of e-cigarettes. Presumably, for cancer, we think that might be a reduction because the cancer-causing compounds in conventional combustible cigarettes are not found in e-cigarettes. So that would be great, except more smokers die of heart disease every year than they do of cancer and lung diseases combined. So we don't want to say reducing the risk for cancer necessarily reduces risk for all other diseases.
Daniel Conklin's own father died of colon cancer at age 46 and was a longtime smoker. That experience spurred him to spend his life researching the effects of smoking and now vaping. The leading e-cigarette company, Juul, is also doing research as it prepares to apply for FDA approval in 2022. But the company remains under legal pressure, not just from the FDA, which has been conducting an investigation into marketing practices by e-cigarette companies, but from Congress, as well as state and local governments, some even going so far as to try to ban sales of e-cigarettes. Today, San Francisco's city supervisors will consider a ban until the FDA completes its review. That ban would be the first of its kind in the U.S. on a relatively new product that we know relatively little about. Tomorrow, we'll talk with a high school principal in Connecticut who's noticed an increase in e-cigarette use among students and says the best way to curb it is to treat it as an addiction.
After revolutionizing the way we interact online, Facebook has now set its sights on your money. Today, the company announced plans for a new digital cryptocurrency. Think Bitcoin, only Facebook's will be called Libra. It's in collaboration with MasterCard and Uber. Facebook has reportedly been secretly working on it for more than a year. So do you trust Facebook with your money? Let's go now to Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Hi, Robin.
So what is Libra? How would it work?
So Libra is one of a variety of coins. We hear a lot about Bitcoin, but there's a ton of cryptocurrencies out there. What makes it most interesting isn't necessarily the technical underpinnings, but who's behind it. As you mentioned, mm-hmm. It's not just Facebook, but it's payment giants like MasterCard. It's big commerce companies like Uber. So what's got everyone talking is who's backing this.
Right. Well, more about that. But first, what's the motivation? There's speculation that Facebook, in promising more privacy to users, may lose some of that ad revenue that they get through sharing users' data, and that this may be a new way for Facebook to make up for that, to make more money through this cryptocurrency. Thoughts?
I definitely think that's a piece of it, if not a large part of it, in that, as you point out, like if they're going to move to more private things, they need to monetize them differently. And what better way to monetize things than with money? There's a lot of money to be made in payments. If you look at WeChat in China as a model, I think, you know, a lot happens on WeChat and a lot of it is payments and micropayments. And I think Facebook looks at that model and says, that could be us. How can we do that? And in the US and in Western Europe, I think it's more difficult to just offer a traditional payments. I think they were looking a little bit further ahead. And so cryptocurrency and having a role could unlock, if you will, a lot of new types of businesses if they're successful.
Huh. But there are also concerns about cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. So let's take one up. They're volatile. You know, the value changes dramatically. So how will Libra's value be determined? What backs it?
So the assets backing it are traditional currencies. So some of the investors are in dollars, other in other currencies. But, you know, there is this move towards what I believe are called stable coins that are designed to be tied to something else in an effort to avoid some of those fluctuations. So I think the goal is how can you take some of the benefits of cryptocurrency without the volatility? I think that's right. What everyone would like to create.
So it could be backed by the U.S. dollar or by euros or something like that.
Sure, a basket of currencies, if you will.
Well, and cryptocurrencies are also used because they are sort of these free-floating things, are often used for illegal transactions like buying drugs online. So how will Libra be, you know, protected, I guess would be the word from that?
I think that's one of the concerns in large part about Facebook going more private is that, yes, it avoids some of the problems in terms of, you know, our information being taken, blah, blah, blah. But what are you opening the door to in terms of hate groups moving behind secret, you know, as you mentioned, illegal currency-based things, whether it's drug trafficking, money laundering, all those sorts of things? I think there's a lot of concerns. I think it's unrealistic to think that the regulators of today aren't going to move into this digital world. I think there was some sense in the beginning of Bitcoin that it could be the wild, wild west and no one will ever know. Well, it turns out every time you want to take Bitcoin off the virtual world and into the real world, the regulators are right there. And I think that would be true of Libra or any other cryptocurrency as well. But certainly to the degree you can spend it more easily, you don't necessarily have to take it into the real world in the same way that you have to exchange Bitcoin for dollars if you want to use it for anything. So I think there are some risks there. In general, I think regulators will find a way to police the crypto world as well, even if it is a little more tricky because it's much less state-tied and much more boundaryless.
Well, we mentioned some of the things that Facebook is dealing with, you know, the privacy concerns, concerns about fake news, hate speech on its platform. A co-founder joined the Voices calling for Facebook to be broken up. You know, it's too big. And, you know, so people were immediately wondering, why would they suddenly announce this thing that has so many questions? Well, we're hearing they've been working on it, you know, for well over a year in secret. And so, you know, it was probably being worked on before a lot of these questions.
Sure.
But also some are wondering, well, maybe it's just trying to shift the focus. Oh, look over there at that. Do you think it's that, or do you think there's something, you know, real, really real going on here with Facebook?
I think it's definitely real. I think the question is, do we want to trust Facebook with our wallets? There's good reason not to. I think if you look at the history of Facebook, they're always moving into new things. And indeed, at their developer conference last year, and I wrote about this in today's login newsletter, they were signaling, look, we're going to try and make things safer, but we're also going to keep building new things. And I think that is the stage Facebook is in. They want to take their responsibilities more seriously, if you believe them, but they also don't want to stop innovating. And they don't want to, in the last year, they've moved into dating, into cryptocurrency, and into a smart camera that lives in your house. So they're clearly not shying away from the concern.
Well, they've also moved into, you know, congressional hearings. So we'll see how this goes. Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young, broadcasting from WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, Ohio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.